Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
In Owning the Secular, Religious Symbols, Culture Wars, Western Fragility, published by Routledge in 2021, Matt Sheedy examines three case studies dealing with religious symbols and cultural identity. Drawing on theories of discourse analysis and ideology critique, the study calls attention to an evolution in how secularism, nationalism, and multiculturalism in Europe and North America are debated and understood as competing groups contest and rearrange the meaning of these terms. This is especially true in the digital age, as online cultures have transformed how information is spread, how we imagine our communities, build alliances, and produce shared meaning. From recent attempts to prohibit religious symbols in public to Trump's so-called Muslim bans to growing disenchantment with the promise of digital media, Owning the Secular turns the lens to how nation-states, organizations, and individuals attempt to own the secular, to manage cultural differences, shore up group identity, and stake a claim to some version of Western values, amidst the growing uncertainties of neoliberal capitalism. In our conversation, we discuss the secular, secularization, and secularism, the role of social media in contemporary cultural wars, anxieties about veiling practices in secular societies, the use of law in governing religion, the new atheist movement, ex-Muslims, and how media shapes public understanding of Muslims. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for joining us on New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. And now here's my conversation with Matt Sheedy about Owning the Secular, Religious Symbols, Culture Wars, Western Fragility. Welcome, Matt. Thanks for joining me on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Great. Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you about your book here, Owning the Secular. Before we get into this, which I must say, I really think is a great book in the sense that you synthesize a lot of information and make it really digestible, so to speak. So I hope people will check it out. And I think it would probably work really well, even in some classes, if not in itself. Maybe some of the sections, but we'll get into those details later. For now, can you tell us a little bit about your background, your training, influences, mentors, moments that shaped you as a scholar, and the types of approaches you take?
Yeah, sure. So I guess I'd start by saying that my undergraduate university career coincided with the September 11th attacks. And so that was a very formative experience for me. It persuaded me to do a major in the study of religion and then go on to do a master's and a PhD. And throughout my training, I was very, very interested in questions of religion in the public sphere, religion in conflict. I also, in the mid-2000s, became very interested in the rise of popular atheism or new atheism. And I was particularly interested in how those types of movements would often utilize Islam as an other or an enemy that they could use to reinforce certain Western secular values. And so those were pretty formative experiences for me that come out in the book in a number of ways. My PhD work with Dr. Ken McKendrick at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, focused on Jürgen Habermas's theory of religion in the public sphere, which became a central part of his work after the September 11th attacks. And so it was very much grounded in those types of questions. And I guess I would also add that throughout my academic training and now into my teaching and research career, I've really been interested in questions of identity politics, culture wars, the kind of things that really get people riled up. Increasingly, I've been interested too in the effects of social media, digital cultures, online movements, and how they're changing the ways that we think and interact. So there's a lot of that contained in this particular book. And I guess the last thing I'll say is that when thinking about culture wars involving Islam in a Western context, I was really, really informed by fairly recent controversies involving Muslim women, involving veiling, and how that rose to the level of a moral panic, how it rose to the level of something that some people perceived as a threat to Western values and Western civilization. There's a number of instances of that that I talk about in the book. And so trying to think about how Western cultures, or Euro-Western or Euro-American cultures, tend to navigate those sorts of issues, especially involving Muslims and Islam, has really come to animate a lot of my work, in that post 9/11 period.
Yeah, it's you can see all these kind of, somewhat unrelated threads come together really well in this book. And I'm wondering if you could start a little bit with the title, Owning the Secular. What do you mean here in this phrasing of owning? Can you tease out what you mean here for us and tell us how it relates to the analysis of your book?
Yeah, sure. So the term owning the secular is something that I use in two particular ways. For scholars who are trained in the study of religion, it's probably pretty well known that debates over the meaning of religion, debates over the meaning of secularism is a really hot potato. It's something that people talk about a lot, and there's no clear consensus on what exactly that means. So, for example, scholars will, in recent decades, talk about how the very concept of religion tends to have a very Western-centric, very Christian-centric kind of idea behind it. And it often doesn't reflect the ways in which a variety of distinct communities, including Muslim communities, indigenous communities, Hindu communities, and so on and so forth, understand and relate to what they might call religion or something analogous, right? So thinking about what this term means in different contexts and thinking about what secularism as religion's opposite or binary pair means is very much a front and center in this work and what I'm thinking about. And so when some scholars make a very clear definition about what they mean by secularism, you know, here are the terms, here's my definition, here's how I'm going to use it, and they follow that process for better or worse, they are in a sense owning their definition, right? They're making their terms very, very clear. And that's something, generally speaking, that I think works pretty well. On the other hand, sometimes scholars will talk about religion or secularism and they won't make their definitions very clear at all. And that can lead to all sorts of problems. It can really get into murky waters when that happens. So I really want to signal in the sense of owning the secular, the importance of being clear in terms of our definitions. The other sense of owning the secular is very much tied to online culture and culture wars. I'm sure some of your listeners will be familiar with language that you sometimes come across online, especially to sell certain video clips, say on YouTube, for example. Clips will read like, you know, so-and-so owns this person, you know, in a debate or discussion, meaning that they've somehow, you know, conquered them or humiliated them. And this sense of owning someone else very much seems to me to be an increasing issue when we're talking about online communication and online cultures, where the ways in which social media is often designed, the way in which it incentivizes certain types of behavior, tends towards people manipulating others, not necessarily engaging critically with others, trying to humiliate them, trying to prove them wrong in some way, as opposed to debating them, thinking with them, really reasoning or rationalizing what the issue at stake is, and so on and so forth, right? And so I wanted to capture those two meanings of the term owning to try to navigate this terrain of religion and secularism, what it means, how it's being used in different contexts, and how we can pick apart these really complicated ideas.
The other part of your title, of course, the secular, and you tackle the secular, secularization, secularism, post-secularism. You kind of offer a sweeping overview of these kind of interrelated topics in the first chapter. How does this genealogy help us understand your project? And what would you say are some of the key moments in this scholarship on these terms?
Yeah, great question. There's a lot of technicalities to this question. I don't want to get into the weeds of it too much. So I guess what I would say is, when thinking about secularism, there's a couple of terms that get thrown around that are really important. One in the study of religion, broadly speaking, is the idea of secularization. And the way that this story usually goes is that, so in many Euro-Western countries and Anglo-American spaces, there was a tendency in the 1960s to notice that fewer and fewer people were, for example, attending church. Explicit references to Christianity or God were becoming less and less. And there was an assumption that these so-called secularizing trends would not only continue to happen over time, over decades, but would also spread throughout the world in such a way that societies all over the globe would eventually become not irreligious, but rather less religious, and where the idea of a separation of church and state, where the idea that people would increasingly keep their religion to themselves and in the private realm would be the order of the day. And so when the Soviet Union collapsed around 1990, sociologists and other scholars of religion started to rethink a lot of these ideas, because it became apparent that once state secularism and the Soviet model started to dissolve, a number of communities started to regroup or reorganize, in part on the basis of a shared religious identity. And this caught scholars' attention, and they started to rethink these older models. Now, importantly, when we're talking about Islam and perceptions of Islam in the West, it was also around this time where the concept clash of civilizations really came to the forefront. As some of your listeners might know, this was a term that was coined by Bernard Lewis in 1990 in an essay that appeared in The Atlantic called The Roots of Muslim Rage. The article itself was just as problematic as that title sounds. And it was picked up by the Harvard political theorist Samuel Huntington in a 1993 essay called The Clash of Civilizations with a question mark at the end. And he later turned that into a book in 1996, where he proposed that there were a number of competing or clashing civilizations, one of which was Islamic civilization, that he theorized would become the next great enemy or great Satan after the collapse of the Soviet Union, in terms of who was in opposition to the Western world, the United States, and so forth. And after the September 11th attacks, popular media picked up Huntington and Lewis's term, the clash of civilizations, and they would reproduce it over and over in various broadcasts. And so this idea that there was a clash of civilizations between quote unquote Islam and the West really came into vogue in the post 9/11 period. But what often doesn't get discussed in that more popular media context is that there is a very, very clear link between the idea of secularization, the idea that societies were, quote unquote, modernizing, moving away from religious identity, and that they were modern, they were reasonable and rational and civilized if they did not have a strong religious presence or outward forms of religious practice under a Western Protestant model. And so when this idea of clash of civilizations comes into the popular imagination, it's very much measuring this sort of Western Protestant model of what a civilized society ought to look like against this other imagined version of Islam and Islamic societies as somehow the opposite or contrary to that. And so part of what I'm doing in this first chapter is trying to set the table for a very, very influential understanding of secularism and that other term, secularization, how it was understood throughout the latter part of the 20th century, how it informed conversations in the post 9/11 period, and how since that time, discussions about secularism as a form of state governance, that is to say, a form in which states like Canada, the US, Germany, where I'm currently living and working from, try to organize or manage people from different communities, including religious communities, in their midst in such a way where they can get along, they can reduce conflict, and so on and so forth. And so in tracing that history and tracing those genealogies, I try to paint a broad picture of where we're at, so to speak, in our thinking when it comes to what secularism means, how it functions in scholarship, how it functions for people in popular conversations, and importantly, how it has transformed over time, particularly in online spaces, which move a lot more rapidly than scholarship does, and often take words, take ideas and concepts like secularism or atheism, and make them their own, so to speak, in ways where they don't necessarily resemble what people commonly associate with those terms.
Yeah, and this part of the book I think would work really well with students introducing this concept or these kind of interrelated concepts in complex but like very legible ways. So for listeners that want to incorporate ideas about secularism into classes on Islam, this might work really well. The other piece here, of course, is you zoom into ideas about cultural wars. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit, I mean, you've kind of already gestured at this, but how contemporary cultural wars line up with assumptions about secular reason and how secular societies operate.
Right. So, I mean, I guess one other thing that's important to say at this point in time is that secularism as a concept tends to refer to at least three particular things. Although if you dug into the weeds, you could definitely find a lot more meanings. But the three ways that I focus on in this book tend to revolve around political secularism, which is to say the way in which nation states will invoke the idea of secularism as a part of their national identity, right? So France, for example, defines itself as a secular state. The Canadian province of Quebec defines itself as secular, and they use the French term laïcité. While Canada doesn't often outwardly describe itself as secular, it's often painted as a secular state, similarly, but for different reasons. The United States does so, and so on and so forth. And so, at the state level, political secularism is an attempt to, as I mentioned before, manage cultural differences between competing communities, communities with different sets of values by creating what is often framed as a neutral set of ideas and values that everyone can share despite their quote unquote religious differences. And one of the real sticking points when it comes to this idea of political secularism as something that is neutral is the critique that if we're talking about Euro-Western states like Canada or the US, they of course have a very Christian and very Protestant-centric understanding of religion. In some cases, Catholic, if you're talking about different regions of those countries. And many critics will point out that even though secularism claims to be neutral within these states, it nonetheless tends to privilege people whose cultural backgrounds refer to customs and rituals and cultural practices that are a lot more familiar in those societies, usually those relating to Christianity as opposed to Islam, Hinduism, Judaism, and so on and so forth. And so when thinking about secularism in our contemporary context, you often hear this idea of state neutrality being invoked, when the reality is that certain groups are always privileged over others. And one of the ways we see this play out is with controversies and conflicts over religious symbols. This is certainly a familiar thing that has happened over the last couple of decades in France, and more recently, as I discuss in the second chapter of the book, Secularism and the Veil, it's something that's been happening in the Canadian province of Quebec for around 15 years or so now, where a number of bills have been introduced in order to restrict certain quote unquote religious symbols in the public sphere. And I tend to frame this as a type of culture war, something that engages with people's own tribal identities, something that tends to be very politically motivated in creating a wedge issue, something that gets people riled up, that forces them to pick particular sides, and that doesn't really necessarily get at what's going on underneath the surface when you're just confronting it, you know, in the news media or in popular culture. And so that intersection between political secularism, between culture wars and how religious symbols often get used as a political football to arguably distract from deeper issues, to divide, that's really something I'm trying to get at in the subtitle. And in part of the book, where I look at these culture wars and how they function to not only distract but also reshape how we think about these categories of religion versus culture versus secularism, and we can get into to more of that as we go along.
Sure. Yeah, and you have a whole chapter that focuses on questions of the relationship between secularism and the veil, and you take us through some interesting case studies. But before getting into the case studies, can you tell us some of the common tropes about veiling practices that you found in quote unquote secular societies?
Sure. Yeah. So, I'm actually working on a book right now that looks at media representations of Muslims and Islam in the West. So it's a topic that's very much of interest to me. And I definitely dig into some of that territory in this book and in that second chapter in particular. And there's a fair bit of scholarship on this, and I don't really have time to go into to all of it. But I would say that for the most part, when we're talking about Islam or any religion for that matter, public discussions, public representations, whether we're talking about, images we see in newspaper, memes, stuff on the nightly news or in TV shows, movies, documentaries, these sorts of things, it only tends to really scratch the surface when we're considering the immense complexity of different religious or different Muslim cultures, cultural practices, different types of theology, different schools of thought, different interpretations, different ideas between insiders or Muslims themselves over what they think about issues such as veiling, to say nothing of, more specific doctrinal practices that most Western audiences probably wouldn't be familiar with. What I would argue we tend to see are images reproduced that tend to be sensationalistic, that tend to sell, and that often fall along what Mahmoud Mamdani calls a good Muslim, bad Muslim model or paradigm. And so bad Muslims, not surprisingly, and certainly in the post 9/11 period, tend to get associated with violence, barbarism, terrorism, the sorts of things that Edward Said talked about in his very influential book, Orientalism, back in 1978. It's also the type of thing that Jack Shaheen covers in his great, I believe, 2006 book, Real Bad Arabs, which was turned into a documentary. The documentary is 2006. I think the book might have been a little bit earlier, but nonetheless, Shaheen covers over 1,000 films of Hollywood reproductions of Arabs and Muslims, looking at a set of familiar tropes that really have come to represent or stand in for Arabs and Muslims in the broader Western imagination. So in addition to some of those tropes that I mentioned regarding Muslims as terroristic, violent, barbarous, and so on and so forth, you have earlier depictions that were familiar in the 18th and 19th century that often focused on harems, that often focused on this idea of the Orient or the Muslim world as something that was exotic and sensual, something that could be seen as the other or the opposite of Western Europe or broader Western parts of the world. When you move into the present period, and I'm skipping over a lot of history and a lot of images here, but when you move into the present period, one thing that really stands out is images of Muslim women and images of veiling. And I would argue that for a number of reasons, but for one in particular, there has been this disproportionate emphasis on Muslim women and veiling. One of the reasons is that it is a visible marker of otherness and a visible marker of Muslimness that stands out as a symbol of Muslims and Islam. Another reason is that in a lot of conversations that really relate to that earlier idea I talked about, the clash of civilizations popularized by Bernard Lewis and Samuel Huntington, the idea that Western liberal democracies are more civilized than the quote unquote Muslim world often revolves around this idea that Western liberal democracies have more rights for women than Muslim majority countries do. And this is often used as a way to say that we in the West are more civilized than Muslims. And there's a growing and extensive literature on this particular topic, particularly following the work of Lila Ahmed and Saba Mahmoud in the late 90s and early 2000s. There's really been an explosion of work thinking about veiling and veiling practices in all its incredibly rich complexity. But from a Western-centric perspective, there is a tendency to frame veiling as something that is related to this idea of Muslims being too religious, that Muslim women are somehow compelled by their religious tradition to veil. They don't have agency, they don't have choice, they're not able to choose for themselves. They are compelled by their religion, they're compelled by their imams, they're compelled by their husbands to wear a veil, and that this is then used as a sign to suggest that the Muslim world is somehow less modern, less progressive, less secular than the West. And of course, when one actually examines and looks into these things, they quickly discover that it's a lot more complicated than that. And so in this chapter, I try to unpack some of the ways in which these images have not only been reproduced in a number of ways in the contemporary era, in the post 9/11 era, but also how they've changed over time, going back to the 18th and 19th centuries, as I mentioned before. And one thing I'll mention specifically in that regard is a wonderful book by Joan Wallach Scott came out in 2018 called Sex and Secularism. And Scott's done a lot of work on secularism. She also wrote a fairly well-known book called The Politics of the Veil in 2007. A lot of her work focuses on France. And this book, Sex and Secularism, also focuses on the French state. It looks at over 100 years of different and competing conceptions of secularism. And what she shows in that book quite clearly is that it wasn't until the early 1990s that the idea of gender equality became linked to the concept of secularism. And since that time, you hear people in discussions about secularism, in discussions about secular values, often in relationship to Western values versus the Muslim world, invoke this idea that our secular values includes gender equality. But again, as Joan Wallach Scott nicely demonstrates, this is a relatively new idea in the history of Western conceptions and uses of the secular. And so in thinking about that, in making people aware of that particular genealogy, I try to explore how this relatively recent association between secularism and gender equality tends to function when it comes to these clashes and controversies involving Muslims in Western spaces. And I also try to show through a variety of case studies how these understandings of secularism, religion, culture, gender, Islam will often change from state to state based on what is of interest to the people who are having a particular conflict and the different players involved. And I can get into that a little bit more as we go along, but those are some of the basic parameters.
Yeah. And you move into two really interesting case studies, kind of examples of these dynamics at play in Canada. One focusing on issues related to the niqab, and then one that's kind of more broadly associated with symbols of religion, but Islam, of course, playing a very central role in this. So can you tell us a little bit about what these situations involved and, how does secularism fit into understandings within the Canadian context that you're talking about?
Sure, yeah. So I think I'll start with the question of the niqab. One thing that really, really got me attuned to this particular topic was a controversy that started in early 2015, specifically January 2015. Now that was an election year in Canada. The Conservative government that was led by Stephen Harper, which was in power from 2006 until October of 2015, was in power for almost 10 years. And there was a federal election coming up at the end of 2015. That was the one that Justin Trudeau of the Liberal Party eventually won. And knowing that the Conservative Party was kind of on the ropes, they were down in the polls, the government at the time seized upon a little known controversy going back to 2011. That government, the Conservative government of Canada, had put in place a restriction whereby Muslim women who were being sworn in for citizenship, for Canadian citizenship, could not wear a niqab, right? So they had to have their entire face exposed if they were to be sworn in for Canadian citizenship. In January of 2015, a then permanent resident, originally from Pakistan, named Zunira Isak, challenged this particular law. And the Harper government at the time seized upon this as a culture war, as a wedge issue. And they actually hired some really savvy political consultants, one that had a lot of success in the UK and in Australia, Lyndon Crosby, to really amp up this issue as a culture war. And the way that the Harper government framed it, he stood up in the House of Commons, right, Canada's equivalent to Congress and or the Senate, and he said that the niqab is something that is contrary to Canadian values and it violates the equality between men and women. Right? So he was invoking, as I mentioned before, this relatively new conception of secularism as a way to frame the niqab as something other, something outside the modern Western secular civilized order. Now, this was ironic for a lot of people because Harper was not known to champion women's rights. But nonetheless, it really became a popular flashpoint or wedge issue. And it was something that Justin Trudeau, at the time, the leader of the Liberal Party of Canada, shot back against. And he said something to the effect that you can choose to like the niqab or dislike it, but this is very much a question of choice, a woman's right to choose, and that we have no right as Canadians to weigh in on that matter. And throughout the entire election campaign, again, this was from late January all the way until October, there was, in my estimation, no single bigger issue than the question of the niqab. And what for me was so interesting about this is that I had barely heard any conversations about the niqab in Canada prior to that time. But all of a sudden, it was mobilized as this huge issue that everyone had an opinion on. despite most people not really understanding what the niqab meant culturally, what it meant theologically, and certainly not what it has meant historically over time in different times and places. And so the niqab affair very much resembled what for me is a prototypical example of how veiling can become a culture war, where a certain cultural or religious symbol gets utilized in order to relive or rehash older debates over secularism versus religiosity, Islam versus the West. What are the lines between religion and culture? What is acceptable? What is unacceptable? And so on and so forth. I can say a little bit more about that perhaps a little bit later, but I do want to get to your second question there. The case of Quebec is really, really interesting. So there have been four prominent bills over the last 12 years or so, dating back to 2010, that involve veiling in particular and religious symbols in general. So without going into all the details, Bill 94 was proposed in 2010, and this proposed putting restrictions on the niqab. This generated some controversy. It failed to pass. And among other things, part of the backlash against this proposed Bill 94 was the idea that this was xenophobic or Islamophobic. And fast forward to 2013, the party at the time, the Parti Québécois, which has a history of being an official separatist party, right, wanting to separate from the rest of Canada, they proposed what they called the Charter of Secular Values. And this proposal wanted to limit or restrict a wide variety of quote unquote religious symbols, including veiling, including Jewish kippahs, including Sikh turbans, and including large, but not small crosses. And there was a lot of interesting debate and controversy at the time, because if you go to Montreal, for example, there's a giant cross on Mont Royal, which is a prominent hill in Montreal. There's also, until very, very recently, the presence of crosses in the Quebec legislature, in various legislatures and municipal buildings in Quebec. And one of the ways in which people within Quebec and politicians responded to this, when people said, well, wait a minute, you're restricting all of these religious symbols, but you're keeping crosses up. And they would respond by saying, well, this is part of our cultural heritage and cultural patrimony, right? And so in that sense, the state was engaged in a process whereby crosses in certain places were deemed culture, whereas other religious symbols were deemed religious and therefore beyond the bounds of an acceptable secular object that could be permitted. For example, when working in the public service as teachers, lawyers, judges, doctors, and so on and so forth. Anyway, I'm getting a little bit carried away with this, but the point I want to zero in on with the Charter of Secular Values is that it originally had this lengthy title that referred to the equality between men and women. And as many commentators at the time pointed out, this was clearly signaling towards veiling practice, right? It was targeting Muslim women in particular. Fast forward to 2017, Bill 62 went back to a targeted restriction on the niqab. That also failed to pass. So these three bills, 2010, 2013, 2017, all failed to pass. Finally, in 2019, the freshly minted Coalition Avenir Québec, which is a sort of right-leaning government, they decided that they were going to go through with the full sweeping ban on religious symbols, or I should say restriction on religious symbols, again, from various jobs in the public service. And they actually passed that bill that year and is still the law that is in place today. And one thing that I analyzed in the book that's really, really interesting to me is that here you see a process whereby the initial attempt to restrict religious symbols specifically targeted Muslim women and the niqab in particular. There was backlash to that, so then they moved to a general religious restrictions ban. So the initial Bill 94 in 2010 gets framed as secularism and the need for gender equality. Then they move to, okay, we're not targeting Muslim women. This is a general ban on all religious symbols. And instead of talking about gender equality, they emphasize state neutrality. Then they go back to a targeted ban on Muslim women. There's backlash, claims of Islamophobia, xenophobia, and so forth. So then finally they switch to a more general ban, right? So this playing back and forth between defining secularism as upholding the values of gender equality on the one hand, and then shifting towards more general restrictions so as to maintain state neutrality, was the kind of political process that was really fascinating to watch unfold in this province. And at the same time, it's reshaping or reimagining how we think of the boundaries between religion, secularism, and also culture. Because as you recall, as I mentioned previously, there were debates at the time over the status of crosses and whether or not that could be classified as culture as opposed to religious. One more point of comparison to mention in that regard, I talk about briefly in the book, is a case study from Reus in Spain, in the state of Catalonia. And back in 2010, there was a proposed ban upon the niqab. And it was proposed at the time by a conservative government that identified as Catholic. And the main party in opposition to this proposed ban was a secularist party. And for the secularist party, they weren't opposed to this ban on any sort of religious grounds. But having a tradition where they were persecuted by the Franco dictatorship in Spain, they really didn't like the overreach or over-securitization of the state. And so they sided with not having this kind of ban on the niqab. And so there was a lot of conversation back and forth. And eventually they decided to ban all face coverings in public. And for good measure, they threw in no public nudity as one of these provisions as well. And so in the process of these debates being worked out, you see this attempt to not appear to be Islamophobic or xenophobic. You see some of the rules changing as to, you know, what is exactly being targeted here. Is it Muslim women or is it just all face coverings in general? And through that process, interestingly, the conservative government, the Catholic conservative government at the time, started to talk about hijabs as opposed to niqabs as a part of Western secular values and our shared collective religious heritage, right? And so they were talking positively for the first time about the hijab as something that we ought to include within our broader understanding of what is an acceptable religious symbol. Whereas the niqab, by contrast, was deemed to be culture, right? It was something that certain cultures did. It wasn't a part of our religious values, and we need to push that to the outside. And so what's really interesting to me is that these particular battles, which are often fought over other things, right? Contests between different political parties. In the case of Quebec and Canada, it is often argued that these controversies are at least in part drummed up because bids for Quebec's separatism, right, which go back to the 1970s, in the mid-1990s, Quebec almost separated from Canada, and there's not a lot of steam for that anymore. And many people argue that those desires by Quebec to draw a line in the sand and distinguish themselves from the rest of Canada are now often playing out in terms of culture wars that most often involve Muslims and Muslim women in particular. And so in a way, you could argue that this culture wars, this targeting of Muslim women, in some sense, reflects deeper battles over Quebec's desire for national autonomy and sovereignty over and against the rest of Canada. And whatever else you might say about people's perceptions of Muslims, Islam, veiling, Muslim women, and so forth, it's also caught up in these much, much broader issues. And teasing out how this works in these different case studies is part of what I try to do in this chapter and in the broader book at large.
Yeah, and you move in the following chapter to questions about new atheists and issues of Muslim, ex-Muslims who've become atheists. For those who maybe aren't familiar with this movement, can you tell us a little bit about some of the main figures of the new atheist movement, some of their main positions, perhaps? And then, you know, there's a very strong strain of anti-Muslim sentiment in their rhetoric. So maybe let us know a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So as I mentioned previously, you know, during my undergrad and graduate work, the new atheists really came into prominence, right? So this is around the mid 2000s, and they remained, I think, quite prominent and popular, really up into the mid 2010s, more or less. And as previously mentioned, these thinkers, including the most prominent among them, the famed Oxford evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, wrote a best-selling book called The God Delusion. Sam Harris, going back to 2004, wrote a book called The End of Faith. The late Christopher Hitchens, 2007, wrote a book called God is Not Great. And today, a lesser-known book that was popular back then, a little bit more academic, was called Breaking the Spell by Daniel Dennett. And there's a number of other figures associated with the New Atheism. But the basic idea behind the New Atheism and their own popularity was framed in popular media, in popular culture, as a response to, on the one hand, the perception of a more intrusive, overly theological, evangelical Christianity in the United States, represented by the George W. Bush administration on the one hand, and also the perception after the 9/11 attacks that Islamic fundamentalism was a threat to Western civilization, and the ways in which these particular thinkers, popular thinkers, framed their atheism was in very much sort of black and white, good versus evil terms. You can see this in the title of Harris's book, for example, right? The End of Faith. And figures like Harris, who are still fairly prominent today, would argue during that time that it was not only important for them to valorize non-religious or atheist identities, but they also wanted to promote a version of atheism or militant atheism that would help bring religion to an end. There's a line from Harris's 2006 book called Letter to a Christian Nation, where he says something to the effect that, let us be honest, in the fullness of time, in the war between science and religion, one side is really going to win and the other side is going to lose. And they soften their stance a little bit later on, and I'll get to that momentarily, but I think it's important to really put a button on the fact that there was this very sort of Manichaean good versus evil framing that informed a lot of ideas about popular atheism during that time. And because it was so controversial, because it was so sensationalistic, it of course helped to get them a lot of popular attention. And this really coincided with the rise of social media. And so they were, in many respects, early adopters of YouTube platforms, YouTube debates, where you would often hear, or rather read titles like, you know, Christopher Hitchens owns stupid Christian women in debate, and that sort of thing, right? And so the new atheists, or the way I talk about them in the book, were very much interested in promoting a version of atheism as one that valorized science and reason as something that they hoped more and more people would adopt, and that this could lead to the idea of, you know, an end of faith over time. But as they engaged with more people, as I think they came up against a lot of brick walls following that very sort of black and white understanding, they came to realize that this particular line of attack has a fairly limited purchase. And so they started to moderate their positions. And you saw this first and foremost with Sam Harris, who had a debate turn into a book with a self-identified liberal British Muslim, Majid Nawaz, in 2014, called, I'm blanking on the title right now, but it has something to do with Islam and the future of tolerance in the title. And it was in that particular book that Harris stopped saying that we need to combat religion, that we need to combat Islam in particular, but we need to work with moderate Muslims. And we need to elevate moderate Muslims who embody secular values as a way to bring in as many Muslims as possible, and therefore take away what he perceived to be the dominant sentiment amongst Muslims in Islam, which, not surprisingly, in his estimation, revolved around this idea that Islam is violent and barbarous, intolerant, and so on and so forth. And so part of what I do in that chapter is I trace some of the shifts and changes in new atheist rhetoric that really occurred from, you know, roughly 2004 to 2014, which marks those two books I just mentioned by Sam Harris. Now, crucially, during that same period of time, we saw social media and social media platforms really come into their own. And I also talk about movement atheism or atheist movements, and how prior to the rise of social media, atheist and non-religious movements, while certainly in existence, here you can think of organizations like American Atheists, which dates back to 1963, if I'm getting that date correctly. You had a number of organizations that were regularly demonized, not well understood, but tended to reflect a fairly consistent set of ideas and ideals. Atheist organizations would often frame themselves as secular, trying to move away from the label of atheist and its negative connotations. And they tended to adhere, broadly speaking, to a certain set of secular liberal values. And they would often identify with other groups, racialized groups, LGBTQ communities, in the sense that they wanted to frame their struggle for greater representation and greater rights as very much in league with racialized groups and LGBTQ groups. But one interesting thing that we see occur in the growing literature on secularism and non-religion, which is really a phenomenon that took off in the late 2000s and certainly continues into the present, is that a lot of people who have come to identify as atheist and non-religious have not latched on to those identities in relation to a brick and mortar secular or atheist organization, right? Where they're meeting in public spaces and necessarily, you know, reading the same books or having the same conversations with a limited group of people. Instead, you see a lot more online communities from all kinds of different cultural backgrounds increasingly saying, I don't identify with religion. I'm a secularist. I'm an atheist. I'm an ex-Christian. I'm an ex-Muslim. And the kind of politics that goes along with that appears to be a lot more diffuse, a lot fuzzier than the stereotypical secular liberal associations that atheism tended to have prior to the rise of social media. And this is also true with a lot of ex-Muslim communities. And maybe I can get into this a little bit more if you have any specific questions about it, Christian. But one final thing I'll say on this particular point is that when it comes to ex-Muslims and ex-Muslim communities, the way in which these controversies in Western spaces often get framed is that, for the most part, liberal media, liberal spaces in Western countries tend to present this version or vision of Islam as very monolithic, as very liberal. It's sort of a good and warm and fuzzy thing that we can assimilate into our broader understanding of liberal multiculturalism. And anything that doesn't look exactly like that, well, that's either not true Islam or it's some aberration, and we can just sort of push that outside the fold. Well, for a lot of ex-Muslims and people who may have had a very bad experience as Muslims, whether in countries like Saudi Arabia or perhaps growing up in certain communities in Canada or the United States, this was seen to be something that was offensive to them, something they didn't identify with, something that they wanted to push back against. And people who identified on the political or cultural right would often provide a platform for ex-Muslims to say really, really bad things about Muslims and Islam. And a lot of self-identified ex-Muslims would grab onto this because this was the community, this was the platform that they were given in order to voice their grievances, often very legitimate grievances in growing up and experiencing fairly repressive religious practices within particular communities. And so the case study I look at throughout this chapter involves a podcaster named Aina of the podcast Polite Conversations. She's of Pakistani heritage, born and raised in an American compound in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, moved to Toronto in her early 20s, and as I mentioned, started this podcast in 2016. And I can say a little bit more about the podcast, but I use her as a device throughout this chapter to look at an example of an individual who describes herself as an ex-Muslim and who identified with a more militant atheist identity when she started her podcast in 2016, but then after Trump was elected, very quickly shifted away from what she saw as these anti-Muslim xenophobic trends within ex-Muslim communities that were latching on to Trump, latching on to a lot of the negative things that we tend to associate with that administration. And it called forth a crisis of identity for Ina. She would often say things like, well, I became an atheist and an ex-Muslim because I believed in secular values. I believed in equality between men and women. I believed in rights for the LGBTQ community and so on and so forth. And what I'm seeing from a lot of my fellow atheists and ex-Muslims is a lot of far-right talking points. And I'm confused. I don't know what this label means anymore. And so I really wanted to dig into the complexities and nuances of this identity crisis that this podcaster has had in her now almost 6 years of being on the air in trying to work out the boundaries of a secular, atheist, and ex-Muslim identity in relation to these shifting cultural trends and culture wars, particularly as they play out in online spaces.
Yeah, it's a really interesting case too. And I think for anyone who's interested in thinking about issues of categorization or classification in the study of religion, this is like a really unique case study to draw into that conversation. There's a lot of detail, of course, in the book that we can't get into, but I do want to congratulate you again. It's very readable. It synthesizes a lot of work in very clear and concise ways. So congrats on a great book, Matt. I'm wondering, you mentioned some of the stuff you're working on right now earlier, but I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about your vision for your current research.
Yeah, sure. So I'm under contract right now for a book that is tentatively titled Islam According to Google News, How Religion Shapes the Way We Talk About Media. And for me, this really goes back to work that I did during my PhD dissertation, or I should say builds on work I did during my PhD dissertation when looking at Jürgen Habermas and his theory of religion in the public sphere. And one of the things that really frustrated me, I guess, when it came to how Habermas talked about religion in the public sphere, is that he would talk about different religions, including Islam, in relation to what I call a liberal Protestant model. And the basic idea, without going into too many details, was that liberal conceptions of religion, that is to say, religion is something that you keep relatively in the private sphere. It is something that is believed, something that you have faith in, something that is very much a product of your personal choice. That is a measurement that he tended to use and apply to all religions. And what happened, or what happens in that process, is that you really lose the immense complexity and specificity of different religious communities, in this case, Muslim communities, how they negotiate their Muslim identities, both in Muslim majority countries and in Western spaces, in incredibly rich and complex ways that are always changing and always evolving over time. And so what I thought would be a really interesting and important thing to do with this book is to try to lay out in fairly broad terms what exactly we mean, or what exactly we talk about when we talk about Muslims and Islam in a Western context. And here I'm thinking about, you know, newspapers, news media, popular culture, movies, these sorts of things. We're definitely not talking about complex theological ideas. We're not talking about debates and disputes between different Muslim communities. We're not even talking about differences between, say, Sunni and Shia communities. We tend to be talking about fairly stereotypical ideas or tropes, stereotypes, buzzwords like jihad, for example. Veiling comes into the picture among a host of other ideas and interests. And those ideas tend to carry the conversation. They tend to get most attention. They tend to be sensationalistic. And I'm interested in this book in basically exploring what are some of the implications of that, right? How do we frame Islam in popular Western media, and what gets left out in the process? And so those are the two things that I really want to explore and grapple with in this book.
Great.
Sounds like an awesome project, Matt, and I wish you the best of luck. And thanks for taking time to talk about this wonderful book.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me.
That was my conversation with Matt Sheedy about Owning the Secular, Religious Symbols, Culture Wars, Western Fragility, published with Routledge in 2021. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.